And it's like, well, but these are donated to the co-op cause, not the newspaper itself. So they don't have like special favors if I give you something, like that kind of thing. But we are hearing a lot of support about that. Some public too. I mean, I know the Warrior Report, Moody was saying a few things a while back about the concern about losing the Tri-Cities publication, right? So we're kind of tapping onto that. And I've heard lots of talk in the communities about the need for something. Like Mario said, miss that newspaper, because these papers went online in 2023, and I think that's how it kind of fell apart, because I don't think, as I tell these companies, you're now competing against the New York Times and like all these places that are way, way bigger than you, and you're trying to vie for their attention, and you're just in all this noise. It's so much better to be, you know, community focused and just be the voice of your community, right? So
while the fundraising period of this campaign is still in its early stages, Gibson says that Unifor, as well as the journalists involved, will be out around in the community this summer promoting the Save Our Local News campaign. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Hey, welcome back to Speak Up. Thanks, Danny, for covering that important issue about local journalism. Do you have an idea for generally like what's next or how hopeful people can be?
Not entirely. I know that their funding goal is 100,000, and I think they're about a quarter of the way there at the moment. Peter Julian, who was the previous MP of New West Burnaby, Myardville, he was at that event, and I think he was one of the first donors. I think he donated about $1,000 or something towards it, which I saw some concern of, like, oh, you know, if all these people who are sort of affiliated with a certain party are giving funding to it, what does that say? But, I mean, when you kind of need all the funding you can get in certain situations like this, I think it's a little hard to avoid. I think they have addressed that, though, in saying that they have been receiving pretty widespread support from, like, all over the political spectrum. As far as progress, though, what they told me is that they're going to be at a lot of different just summer events happening over the next few months, sort of campaigning for and explaining what this initiative entails, and that hopefully the outcome for it is a publication that will, you know, encompass Burnaby, New West, and the Tri-Cities, which would end up being about like six municipalities in total.
Well, I mean, as we've seen, there's definitely room. Like, there's definitely demand for that, for coverage of those areas. And there's enough going on that, you know, we can't cover everything that's going on. And so it would be nice,
to have those friendly faces going around and giving, providing a voice to the community in that way. And one thing about it that really, really interested me is that they don't want it to just be an online publication like a lot of news outlets are today. They want to bring back a physical paper.
Yeah.
Because I think that is something that, from what they've heard, a lot of people within these communities really do miss. Because even before these closures, physical print publication was something that was becoming less and less available.
Totally. There are financial challenges there, but I also think that people do want to be able to just pick something up and read it, and I mean, that's what advertisers want too, right? So I hate to move on so quickly, but I do want to make sure that the recording of the Indigenous Wisdom Meets Emerging Technology panel from Web Summit Vancouver a couple weeks ago, that we can play the whole thing, because I tried to play it last week and ran out of time. So I just want to make sure we get there. This is featuring Ethan Clark, Carol Ann Hilton, and James DeLorme, and is moderated by Donna Sound, who is the first person you will hear speaking right now.
Okay, I'm going to start with you, Ethan. Can you tell me what a blockchain is and how it can positively affect Indigenous communities?
Yeah, so a blockchain is a publicly owned ledger. The easiest way to think about it
It is distributed compute amongst many, many computers, and the actual users of the network own their data or own their digital assets. Of course, it creates a ton of potential for applications to be built on top of it with that same mechanism in mind, and custody ship of data or assets is a necessity for our people in order to advance and move forward.
And so in what ways can blockchain technologies be adapted to preserve and protect indigenous cultural knowledge while respecting traditional protocols of sharing and protecting sacred information?
So I think, culture is many things, and oftentimes we see art, we see language, we see song, dance, many, many things, but it's also, economic systems, governance structures, our relationship to the land, or how we value the land, how we value the oceans, how we value each other. It's a new foundation that we can build on top of, and specific aspects of technology, like, such as a consensus mechanism. Everybody's heard of sort of proof of work, similar to Bitcoin, or proof of stake, similar to like Ethereum. There's others. There's delegated proof of stake where, the three of us could give you our vote. And that allows us to start really tailoring our governance structures within the network or within the applications. Also, putting value on things and being able to actually tokenize, creating digital twins of data, of these assets, in order to really bring out the value of our lands, bring out the value of our ecosystems or our economies, in order to really self-determine and really set the goalposts for where value is and where we're heading to.
That's great. James, how might indigenous ways of understanding the world change the way we design and use artificial intelligence?
Oh, you open that can of worms. Imot Samswagen, Kochu Kapi, Nishtaskejim. And so I was speaking in Ijutham, and the reason why I say I spoke in some of the language is because we have to bring our ancestors into the room. We have to bring our cultural beliefs, our cultural values. Tech is one thing, and you heard some really important pieces that Ethan just talked about. But we also have to bring our ancestors with us. We have to bring our relatives with us as we go along this journey. And I really view, let's just use generative AI as an example, which you mentioned. That's a tool, folks, but we have to make sure that it's human-centered, that tool is actually driven by indigenous knowledge with the indigenous lens. So it's really critical, how do we do that? What are the important pieces about our culture and our values, the indigenous law? How is that implemented in policy, regulation, and not to go too deep into that discussion, but it's really important to keep your tradition and your ancestors in the conversation.
And are either of you using AI to help protect our dying languages? And is that something that we need to be doing?
I don't use it for the language aspect, although, of course, that's been a conversation that we've had a lot. And there's huge opportunity there. I come from a language, the Squalum language, is a Coast Salish dialect. We actually just lost the last speaker of our language about a year ago. And of course, there are there's programs, there's a dictionary, there's a couple of them, but there's no one that's really grown up and spoken the language, since birth. And so I would say that there's a ton of potential there, and I think that there needs to be the right funding in place, there needs to be the right training in place and opportunities in place to support other Indigenous entrepreneurs, even to just break into the space, right? I know when I was younger, I wouldn't have thought that this, getting into technology was possible. So I would support anybody that would be doing that work, and I have seen people doing that work.
Well, that's great. James, can you add to that? And the importance of, our language is, anyone's language, it's your soul, right? It's who we are as a people, and we can't lose it. Like, that's so sad to hear about, your last speaker has just passed, and I've been hearing that a lot, that in our differing First Nation communities, and it's something that we really need to work on.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree even more. Thank you for bringing that up, actually. Critically, it's important. Obviously, I'm speaking Adutham, so I've been fortunate or privileged to be able to have that elders teach me that language. What is it now? What are those tools that obviously are becoming centric to our lives? How are we benefiting from that to actually keep those languages alive? And the elders, as mentioned, that it's a, like I said, it's a critical stage. How are those tools being able to be developed so that obviously AI is going to be a part of that, and it's how the language to text, how the text to language, how that all the LLM is going to be developed in a way that captures that language, the LLM understands what that is, but you have a moral layer as well that goes along with that process. That's the critical key, and the Indigenous lens has to be a part of that process.
Definitely. Can you share some examples of how Indigenous-led technological innovations are creating alternative models for digital development?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of different ways that we're using these tools now. And unfortunately, there's a bit of a gap. But I think one of the messages that I wanted to come here today was to say, let's look at our successes. Let's look at the things that are really the spaces where people are actually using these tools in a way that's manifesting into good projects for our communities. Language revitalization, that's a key theme and theme topic. But there's also economic reconciliation, and Caroline actually can, I don't want to steal anybody's thunder today, but Caroline is an expert, I would say, and I say that with humility, that Caroline's a good friend of mine, and deeply respect her opinions. But what I want to say, though, is that it's impacting, if you understand Indigenous lens, folks, so it's not just one thing. It's not in a silo. It's all of our lives. Everything that we do as Indigenous people, it affects everything we do, but it's part of our ecosystem, if you will. I don't want to use that word either. It's part of who we are as a community that matters the most. So if somebody says, oh, hey, Ethan's an environmentalist, or James isn't, that's not our worldview. We are who we are as Indigenous people, and we care about our environment, our people, and our lands.
James, can you tell me more about Digital Link? Or Indigilink, sorry. Indigilink Digital.
Yeah, thanks. It's a company I started quite a few years ago, and it was a research company on Indigenous blockchain. And really, it's kind of weird because it's not quite normal to say Indigenous blockchain, but it's the research that has to take place. I firmly believe that we still need to, for early adoption, we have a long way to go, but we need to do the research. And so my company does that, and I've been doing that for a very long time, since the birth of the internet, quite honestly. But what it means is that that research is critical to tangible actions, tangible projects, pilot projects, if you will, that are going to maybe have that transition of that technology. That's going to have the Indigenous lens. So that was the whole idea behind the work of that research.
So Ethan, you also have a tech company, Nations First Technologies. How is it different from James's?
So Nations First is, we focus on working with First Nations. We built a blockchain network, an entirely independent blockchain network, where we tokenize, again, making those digital twins of these natural resources, the energy assets, the ecosystem, so all the biodiversity, carbon, soil, water, etc., and addressing issues like investment into our projects, into our resource projects, and you know, that ultimately trickles down into the community, and you know, just providing them with the dignity of a home and services within their community and that sort of work, and so. While also protecting the community from predatory investment that may...
Can you give me some examples of what you're talking about?
Yeah, so, you know, oftentimes we see major, you know, resource developers come in and totally bypass the community, or, you know, they might make predatory investments into the community, threatening its sovereignty or its title to its land, and so we've designed a system that makes very clear compliance within the nation, very clear investment into the projects, and you know, everything is audited by the community. And so, you know, we're very niche, but we also are working in quite a legacy industry and large space.
Okay, that's great. Carolyn, you created Indigenomics Institute, and you identified the potential value of the indigenous community economy in Canada at more than $100 billion. That's a lot. So how did you come up with this number?
The first centering of a potential of the indigenous economy was based on if the indigenous population is close to 5% of the total population. If we were a generative indigenous economy, it would equate to about 5% of the total, would be about $100 billion. And while that number was identified within 2019, which at the time the valuation was around $32 billion, the escalation of the continued demonstration of indigenous economic value and how that is happening is essentially shifting the way we understand indigenous economic activity and our participation within the larger Canadian economy.
Okay, so you tell me more about your company.
So the Indigenomics Institute is a financial technology company. We do modern indigenous economic design. We look at a platform that identifies how we describe ourselves as indigenous economic powerhouses and how we center our relationship in the Canadian economy as both legal and economic. And while there's a weighted demonstration of that on the legal side, the expression of that on the economic side is essential to begin to bring value to. If we look in the historical structure of the Indian Act, the intention was never for Indigenous peoples to have an economy, and it exists to this day that the absence of Indigenous economic participation is built into the Indian Act itself. And while we have many nations who are across many different definitions, whether that's historical treaty, modern treaty, different variations of self-government or identification, it's essential to understand that every single person within this country, from the beginning until now, whether newcomers or longer settlers, that every single person in this country has been negatively and continues to be negatively impacted by the Indian Act. So what our work at the Institute is doing is focusing on framing that impact, framing generative Indigenous economic activity, describing how we create value specifically because of who we uniquely are as having rights within this country. And we are building an Indigenomics AI system to demonstrate in a powerful way an increase of the evolution of Indigenous economic activity, but also moving that beyond GDP and looking at how is value creation happening, how do we look at that demonstration of how we do business, as well as the larger impact of that. So building an Indigenomics AI economic intelligence platform to really think about how we think about economic intelligence, what we know as Indigenous people, and coming back to what you were speaking of, that how do we build that from our values, and how do we build that from the leadership of what our responsibilities are as Indigenous people.
What, Caroline, what is your view on, you know, First Nations people, Indigenous people, using AI to protect, you know, our many dying languages?
I think that it's a beautiful tool that's presenting itself in front of us at this time, and it's a powerful tool, and our ability to see its capabilities, our ability to not have it be an answer for us, but in our toolbox of everything that we put in that toolbox, of whether that's our rights or whether that's our stewardship practices or our data governance or any of those aspects, our ability to utilize that tool in a powerful way that stems from our core values as people in terms of respect and caring for and future generations and abundance that's based in sustainability. when we can build and design from that place of power, that's that transmission of those teachings across time and those responsibilities, this represents a powerful moment of our ability to shift away from that story and experience of what's happened to us to move towards design bias. And that's the opportunity that technology provides us today as Indigenous people, both in business and in nation building.
You said, you said to Canadians, get ready. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the primary foundation of our work in Canada, while that's focused on a construct of $100 billion, how do we demonstrate that through data analysis? How we demonstrate that through economic reconciliation outcomes? It was during the pandemic that I started tracking kind of projects over the billion-dollar level, whether that was investment or land value or whatever those aspects within the economic development realm were. And it came quickly to my realization that the escalation of economic value was something that needed to be paid attention to. And with the first version of Indigenomics AI, we were easily able to identify $100 billion of Indigenous economic activity. And while Statistics Canada or the federal government are currently valuing the Indigenous economy at around $50 billion, to understand actually the true value of the projects and the investments, the assets, the combination of those to really understand a larger perspective of value and impact. The concept of get ready is we're well beyond $100 billion, and that what allowed us to respond to the Indigenous and legal relationship, for example, at $32 billion or $50 billion, what we're looking at right now is economic power. And we're looking at Indigenous resilience and how that expresses through our ability to pick up technology. To be get ready means that we're looking at the next $100 billion of Indigenous economic activity with AI as a tool that supports our stewardship responsibilities within our territories, our governing systems, and our economies. And that's a powerful combination that supports our return to our ability to make decisions about our future.
What about AI do you see as a negative?
I think that where I'm most intrigued is while we consistently hear about the amount of water usage that's critical in the deployment of AI, I think that where we see less conversation is who is innovating in that space. And I think that the emergence of Indigenous data centers is going to be a critical trend in the Indigenous economy, in Indigenous governance, and Indigenous conservation practices. And our ability to focus on innovation and the partnerships that lead with the values of what is possible, I think Indigenous innovation around data centers will in itself, our perspective and worldview, I think it is a critical moment of the energy usage and water usage specifically, but I think our ability to be at the table and to be at the partnerships and to be present in the innovation is essential.
Would you say that, your tech companies are helping us take our space in this society?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, take it back, because of the reserve system in the Indian Act.
Yeah, in my first book, I used that example of the metaphor of taking our seat at the economic table. And that doesn't mean their economic table. It means our ability to sit in our seat of our responsibility, our ability to govern, our ability to operate from our worldview. And every time Indigenous peoples win a legal case, we win it in the courtroom and it's expressed in the economy. and nobody is making room for us at the table. We're systematically, case by case, defining our modernity. We're case by case representing our belonging in this moment, in our own future. And to understand the inheritance of that legacy that denied us that space, it didn't just deny us a space at the economic table. This system denied our space in our own future. And I think that the resilience that we show up in this moment, having a conversation in this generation about the possibility of technology, about how we step back into our responsibilities with it, I think it's a powerful, beautiful moment that we're in.
Yeah, that's so true. You just came out with another book. You just published in April. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I have my first book was called Indigenomics, Taking a Seat at the Economic Table, and my second book was called The Rise of the Indigenous Economy and the Deconstruction of Indian Act Economics. So I position the analysis of economic value of demonstrating what does it mean, the rise of Indigenous economic power? What does economic power look like? How do we see it? How does it show up in the Canadian narrative? In terms of the deconstruction of Indian Act economics, I read the Indian Act into our AI system and played with the reflection back to understand that what is woven, the weaving of content and the ugliness that's actually the words that are used and the mystery of how that shapes meaning that created a destiny specifically for us as Indigenous people, the dysfunction of that and how that represents our continued being affected by that. To use AI to bring, okay, if a grade 8 person was to read this, what does this say? And a simplification of it. And then the ability to take that and say, if the Indian Act was a person, how would it say? What would it sound? What is this person saying? So we all know this as Indigenous people. You know, you're not allowed to move. You're not allowed to speak your language. We'll look after your money. You can't have your own money. You can't have your own land. So all of these aspects that when you take the Indian Act as a person and do a AI-generated mental illness analysis of it, we come out with a perspective that describes this is a sickness. This is an illusion that what has affected us as Indigenous people to speak to the illusion and to speak to the illness of this moment, of what we know to be true. I think that the utilization of AI to demonstrate the advancement of language in a position that outlines what that means to deconstruct Indian Act economics, and in that in itself, the placing the ethical space of the Indian Act into Canadian reality, that it's time to start talking about Indian Act economics, that it's time to start speaking to, in the ethical framework of a country, to remain the resilience of who we are, that we push every single day within our communities. I suggest within this concept of deconstructing Indian Act economics that as the rise of Indigenous economic power is happening every single day around us, with that rise, what we're experiencing is the increasing irrelevance of the Indian Act itself. And I get asked that so many times of, you know, should we dismantle the Indian Act? And while there's
And I'm sorry to have to cut you off, Caroline. We are out of time, unfortunately. Ethan and James, and thank you for being here and having this great conversation. I just wish we had more time. And thank you all for being here as well.
The panel, Indigenous Wisdom Meets Emerging Technology at Web Summit Vancouver, which happened at the beginning of this month, right here in Vancouver. Democracy Now! Is up next. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse. Danny was here earlier. And that's it. See you next time.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., Tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.